Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 9th, and I'm very excited. This is the first day that we're actually going to start hearing bills, and I'm delighted that we're going to start in the area of child abuse and foster care. These are two of the areas that have been really high priority for this committee, and we've had great interaction with some of the people here in the room, some of the organizations, and I'm delighted to continue to try to make progress in this area. We have several representatives who want to make a statement on some of the bills that they are sponsoring, and they have to run off to other committees. So we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2216, Foster Children Sibling Bill of Rights, and invite up Representative Susan McLean.
Thank you so much. Well, good morning, committee, and thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate you allowing us to go first on the Foster Bill of Rights, which is House Bill 2216. And I'm here basically as a teacher of 42 years. And during my career as a teacher, a high school teacher, there were many foster students who came through my classrooms. And these were students that were really very, very, I guess I would say it sometimes during the program that they were going through and the experiences they were going through, they really needed support. They needed a stable family. And one of the ways that they can have that stable family besides foster parenting and the foster family is through having a connection with their siblings. And I don't think anyone can deny the connection between siblings and how important and how strong that connection really is. That connection and that support and that encouragement that the foster youth can get through having that connection with their siblings is really, really important. Our foster system and values should be more geared to providing that family and the family members and siblings with a proactive, a very safe, and a connected plan that works for each sibling. During the time of upheaval, that connection with a brother or a sister is the only constant relationship they have in a sea of changes. And in House Bill 2216, with the amendments, it goes a long way to making this possible. The Sibling Bill of Rights provides knowledge and it provides them an opportunity to have input, and it gives a very stable and a very safe individualized plan that suits each one of the siblings in the group, and it gives them an opportunity for a family relationship to flourish under the foster youth placement. I really am in favor of this. I had four youth who came in to talk to me the other day, and they were absolutely fabulous. They were proactive. They really laid out exactly what this particular Bill of Rights can really do for them. And this is a bill that I think is really going to provide a structure and a framework for us to support them. They're supporting themselves by coming and letting us know exactly what they need. And I think we should get out of their way and let them do it. So thank you very much. And I know you're going to hear from some fine people today that have worked really hard on this Bill of Rights. And I really support it, and I hope you can too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to have a lot of speakers on this. If you have questions, you might want to hold off. But if there's anything burning just for her.
Oh, I have one.
Chance? Go ahead. Chair.
Yeah. Is your colleague going to testify?
You know what? Senator Gelser is going to explain this to you. But that is also a bill that I have a lot of support for. And I hope you'll take that one very, very seriously as well. Because I think you've got some opportunities to be really proactive and really supportive of families and young people today.
Great.
So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. We are going to suspend the hearing on House Bill 2216, and we'll suspend this one. And then we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2221, Reimbursement of Child Abuse Medical Assessments. Representative Wisnant, we're going to go back and have our committee analyst read what these bills are about, but for the purpose of allowing you to get back to your committee, we'll let you make your statement, and then we will go back to the normal order of having her read the bill and opening up for public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping the senator would be here and explain my friend here.
She is stuck in traffic and will show up in about 2 minutes.
Madam Chair and honorable colleagues, I'm Gene Wisnant, State Rep, House District 53, for the record. Thank you for hearing this bill. And my friend here is symbolizing when the children come into the centers to be interviewed, they try to give them a week donate, community donates bears to calm the child down. So I hope that since we introduced this bill, I wish there would be no further need for, like in my district, the diagnostic centers is called the kids center, but sadly we do still need kids centers, and they provide a valuable service. In 2014, child abuse intervention centers like the Kids Center in Deschutes County came to me with concerns about the difficulty they were having getting paid for their absolutely critical services they provided. With this, the help of this committee in 2015, we passed House Bill 2234, passed unanimously through both chambers. And what it was doing is they were getting funding for the initial interview, but not receiving funding for the follow-on treatment that was required. And that's what House Bill 2234 did, is provided for that. We come back to you, like a lot of bills, that sometimes the bill doesn't exactly perfect is explaining what's supposed to be done. We've had conversation with the Oregon Health Authority and other ones, like in my district, Specific Source, and they've tried to work with us, and we've come up with this bill that you're going to hear today, and I understand, hopefully pass on, because I think there's no opposition from the supporters or the suppliers of these services. So this bill just clarifies how much and when the payment, and urges them to pay these follow-on treatment earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's what the bill is. I strongly urge you to support it, as you did the bill in the past, so we can be sure that with more funding, what the result is, we're going to treat more children. So that's the key thing. So you're playing an important role in that. And Madam Chair and honorable colleagues, I hope you'll pass the bill today.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Any questions for Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think I would feel better about the bill if I could take a picture of you holding the teddy bear.
Ah.
They wanted me to hug the bear. We're going to call it Ramos today.
So. There we go. That's good. All right.
Hey, there's a sporting event that almost reaches the level of Super Bowl, North Carolina Duke basketball.
Okay. Perfect timing.
She could testify on this one.
On both. Right. You're up, Senator Gosar.
I'm supposed to have the bear.
Senator Gelser, thank you for joining us. And
thank
right
you.
Now, we are on air.
Oh, no, okay,
wait.
That's a great bear.
Oh, this day's been strange so far, and it's only
I didn't think Gene gave it his all.
We are right now, we're hearing House Bill 2221, reimbursement of child abuse medical assessments, and then we will go back to the Sibling Bill of Rights.
Wonderful. Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath, and I apologize as my voice cuts in and out. I believe that's known as the capital crud. So thank you so much for scheduling a hearing on this bill. I know we've been here to talk to you about this issue before. It's unfortunate that we have to come back and talk to you about it again. I just commend to you that this is incredibly important. Our child abuse assessment centers are doing incredible work serving kids in an urgent and compassionate kind of way. They create a place that is safe and healing for children to come to after they have experienced the type of trauma that most of us can't imagine. And although the people that work at these centers are there every day with a passion, that work can't be done for free. And these are medical assessments. These are appropriately reimbursed through medical coverage, and they should be. This bill is intended to get us closer to that, and I just strongly urge your aye vote.
Great. Any questions for Senator Gelser on this bill? Okay, I am going to suspend opening that one. I'm going to reopen House Bill 2216, Foster Children Siblings Bill of Rights.
Wonderful. And may my friend the bear stay
yes.
for this one.
She
pushed him over. I'm a terrible friend.
Might be here for the whole hearing.
That will teach you all to sit next to me. So, for your record, my name is still Sarah Gelser. I still represent Corvallis, Willamette, and Albany. Thank you again for opening this bill. The Siblings Bill of Rights is extraordinary for a number of reasons, the most important being this is a concept that comes to us from foster youth themselves. And as we all wrestle with the issues in our child safety and child welfare system, what I think is important to remember is the true experts in this, the people that have the biggest stake in this, are the youth themselves who live and work through this system. And as I've had the real privilege to get to know a number of foster youth over the last several years, one of the key issues that people raise is the importance of family connection, and especially those connections to a brother or a sister. If you think about your own brother or sister, if you have them, I'm fortunate to have three younger brothers that I can't imagine not having in my life. Those are the people that I share a history with. We share experiences. If you imagine that, you know, the traumas that we have shared that don't compare to the traumas that some of these kids have shared, that is just the basis of security. I know there's one foster youth that I've been working with for the last couple years. She and I speak regularly, and the biggest fear that she has is that her brother right now is in the process of being adopted. And she has been told, and we're working to resolve this, that once that adoption is finalized, because that family is not adopting her, that she may not have the opportunity to have a relationship or have any contact with her brother again. That is a devastating thing. That is not fair to her. That is not fair to her brother. That is played out over and over again, sometimes not by intention. It's by a matter of practicality. But the elements of this bill really speak to the importance of that relationship, of keeping the experience and the wellness of children and youth at the center of the work that we do. I know that there are some technical questions around the language about mandating and ensuring the ongoing contact between siblings if they are adopted through different families. I would urge you that is an incredibly important element of the bill. There has to be a way to get there. I'm an adoptive parent. We participate in an open adoption. We have ongoing contact with birth parents and birth grandparents and now younger birth siblings. That is a magical and rich part of our lives. If we could make sure that is something that is available to children and youth that go to their forever families through the foster care system as well, that is one of the most important things that I think that we can do for young people. Family is a big thing. No one can have too many people to love them, and everyone deserves to remain in contact with their brother or sister. So I urge you to listen to these youth and move this bill forward. I hope we get to see it in the Senate before too long.
That's great. Any questions for Senator Gelser? I know you've got a committee meeting coming up too. So thank you so much for all your work in this area.
Thank you. And nice work.
Bye.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we currently have open House Bill 2216. I want to give you a sense of the order because it's not going to follow the order on the agenda here. We're going to continue on 2216 and open it up for public testimony. Then we will go back to 2221, child abuse medical assessments. Then we'll go to 2344, qualifications and requirements for minors in independent living programs. Then 2401, trauma-informed training for child welfare personnel. And then House Bill 2500, continuing education for caseworkers on juvenile dependency proceedings. And we will now go back to a regular order and ask our committee analyst, Cassie, to please read the summary of the Foster Children Sibling Bill of Rights.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2216 establishes specified rights for foster children. The bill directs Department of Human Services to adopt rules establishing the Oregon Foster Children Sibling Bill of Rights. It also directs DHS to review the rules periodically and promote participation of current and former foster children in developing the rules.
Thank you. And Representative Peluso, as a co-chief sponsor, would you like to come up and introduce.
I would like to close.
Oh, great.
So if someone else could do that, I would appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, perfect. Then we've got youth from the Oregon Foster Youth Connection here to testify. So please come on up. Lupe, Alexis, and Dano. Please state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Lupe Rankin. Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. Thank you for having us today. We'd like to start out with sharing a bit about Oregon Foster Youth Connections, the program of Children First for Oregon we are representing today. OFYC is a statewide youth-led group of current and former foster youth who aim to improve Oregon's foster system through advocacy, activism, and leadership. Currently, OFYC consists of three chapters: Lane County, Marion, and Polk County, Tri-County, with potential growth of chapters in Central and Southern Oregon. OFYC has been involved in passing of five prior bills, as well as one Senate bill. So how the bill came to be about: the concept of HB 2216, Sibling Bill of Rights, blossomed at OFYC's 2016 policy conference, where 31 current and former foster youth dove into the tough problems DHS caseworkers, foster youth, and foster parents are experiencing in Oregon at this time. On July 19th of 2016, many of us presented multiple recommendations to audiences of lawmakers, administrators, and service providers. Of the seven policy suggestions, OFYC members chose Sibling Connections as a top priority to bring forward to legislators this legislative session.
Great, thank you.
Honorable Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Stark, thank you for having us today. My name is Daniel Menino. I am 23 years old, and I am a former foster youth from Jackson County. And I am also a member of Oregon Foster Youth Connection. And I'd like to share a little bit about my story today. I was in foster care and temporary guardianship between the ages of 8 and 14, separated from my older sibling. Prior to my placement, my sister was my greatest companion and support through a time of abuse and neglect from our biological parents. Amidst the turmoil of poverty, repeated lice infestations, and witnessing domestic violence and my parents' severe mental illness, my sister helped me feel like life was worth living and that something positive could come out of our situation. After my parents' divorce, around the time my sister was 13, she had stayed with a church friend and his parents temporarily while my mother was in the hospital and respite for a psychotic break. They didn't have room for me, and as I bounced around from various friends' parents around the neighborhood, while we waited for my mother to be discharged, I was placed in the system. My sister's friend's parents became foster parents to continue her care, and I was placed an hour away by DHS. My sister was told she could move in where I was living. However, she would have to leave her teachers and friends at the school she had finally gotten settled into, and her church youth group, which was one of her most important support systems besides me. She felt that her life was being completely torn apart and that the adults who were in her life were pressuring her into a certain direction, which was to stay where she was already placed. In the 2 years that followed, my foster parents frequently spoke about my sister's religion as well as her weight in a derogatory manner, and I didn't feel that they were supporting my relationship with my sister. When my mother had finished her parenting classes after many supervised visits, I was placed with my mother again. My sister remained with her foster family as she was old enough to age out with them with a parental signature, which my mom signed. Less than a year into living with my mother, I called up my former foster parents and begged them to take me back, and surprisingly, they did under temporary guardianship. During that time, I was 10 to 14, and visits with my sister were not made a priority. When my sister was 16 years old, I remember her driving to see me on the weekend, even though she was petrified of getting onto the freeway to spend time playing cards with me. When my temporary guardians chose not to adopt me in my early teens, they returned me to my birth mother, who I lived with until I was 17. Not only was I struggling with feeling rejected, I was struggling with high school because I had, you know, moved schools so many times, being bullied for being bisexual and gender nonconforming, and struggling to keep up with the coursework. I was also struggling with my own mental health, as I have generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and bipolar type 2. Only one of those diagnoses was diagnosed at the time, and I also was not in therapy or on medication. I was at risk for developing addiction, self-harm, and suicidal behaviors. In retrospect, I realized a lot of the coping skills I did acquire in my avoidance of those were also not positive. My sister was able to help me find independent housing and get ready to test for my GED. Around the time I was 17, I moved out from where I was with my mom. Over time, I've been able to begin the mental health care I need. I consider myself a youth that sort of fell through the cracks, and without my sibling finally being accessible, I'm not sure I would be alive today. Being able to reconnect as adults with my sibling and making up for lost time as best we could was an opportunity that most siblings who get separated in care are not afforded. Had a bill like HB 2216 existed back then, I believe DHS could have been encouraged to help my sister and I get a placement together that worked for us both, or at least placements in closer proximity to each other. Had it been decided our respective separate placements were still the best choice for us, which may have been the case, a bill like HB 2216 would have encouraged our caseworkers and respective foster parents to coordinate more frequent and better quality visitations for us both. In addition, transportation assistance could have been provided so my sister wouldn't have to drive on the freeway as a new driver. Had a sibling bill of rights been posted in my foster home, I would have known I could speak out about how I felt I wasn't being given the support and seeing my sibling that I really wanted and needed. Lastly, I would have been able to understand more clearly why my sister and I were in separate homes and whether she was being adopted by her long-term foster parents instead of returning home with me to our biological home. I hope that with your support in the passing of HB 2216, foster youth in Jackson County and other counties throughout Oregon will be able to have a better experience in care in relation to their siblings than I had. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for sharing your story.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Representative Stark, Vice Chair Representative Sanchez. For the record, my name is Alexis Baska, and I'd like to thank you for having us here today. I'm 20 years old, and I currently live in Washington County. When I entered the foster care system, I was 15. I was a freshman in high school, which is already about as tough as it gets. But my father had just passed away. I was separated from my mother, and the hardest part was being separated from my siblings. So I am the oldest of my father's three daughters, and something that was always driven into my head was, all right, you're the oldest, like you need to watch out for your little sisters, you need to protect them, and most importantly, be a role model to them, which was something that I worked hard to do. Their mom wasn't super involved in their life. We have separate mothers, they're my half-siblings. So I took over that role. I taught them how to do their hair. I painted their nails, things like that, until I was separated from them. So I had a very maternal instinct with my siblings, which was very hard to be in that role and then have no contact with them. Not only was I dealing with the loss of our father and no contact with my mom, but I was worried about my sisters. I was like, okay, well, what are they doing? Are they okay? Are they safe? Because I was placed in the foster care system and they were placed into guardianship with a relative that I don't have contact with. It was tough. All I wanted was to see my sisters. I would ask the court, I'd ask the judge, my lawyer, my caseworker, is there any way that I can get in contact with my sisters? Can I have meetings, phone calls, anything? And because they were in guardianship and I was in foster care, there was nothing that they could do. I'd always wished that something like this had existed. I think that keeping in contact with my siblings would have helped reduce the trauma, anxiety, and depression that I endured. In House Bill 2216, siblings will be given the right to an adoption placement where sibling contact is encouraged. In the current draft of our First Amendment, which I will share in a moment, there should be a conversation with prospective guardians or adoptive parents on how important maintaining sibling contact is, something that would have helped my case. I think that if I would have had somebody to reach out to the guardians of my sisters to say, you know, how beneficial it is, that the possibility of me having contact with them would have been greater. Now I'm working to rebuild a connection with my sisters, but it's hard because you've known someone from birth. I can remember my first sister being born, going to the hospital, freaked out. I was like, what's going on? And then to know everything about them, and 5 years later, them be strangers to you. I couldn't tell you my sister's favorite color. I could tell you when she was six, but now it's difficult. It's interesting to be in that role. Some of the amendments, to unofficial amendments, might I add, to our bill are to include the definition of siblings as already in statute, to have rights explained to each sibling and valuable for them to read, available, just joking, available for them to read, to have rights as safe and appropriate for each individual sibling, to have a safe and appropriate conversation if siblings cannot be placed together or have limited contact, to have siblings involved in the creation of the sibling contact plan, to have the sibling contact plan reviewed regularly, to ensure siblings have these rights even if their parents' rights are terminated, to have caseworkers educated in the importance of sibling relationships in addition to foster parents, and as I have mentioned previously, to remove the mandated relationship after adoption, but to ensure conversation about the importance of sibling relationships in adoption and guardianship plans.
Fantastic. Thank you all so much. Questions? Representative Gorsuch.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's more of a comment than a question. You're all wonderful presenters, and you should be very proud of what you've done today. It's very impressive. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Chair. Lupe, can you give me an idea of some of the other things that you all? I know that there were. I was there, but I know that there were other things on your agenda, and I just want to give people an idea of some other bills that might be coming at them soon, because I think it's really, really important, and you all are the best people to represent the work that you need done in the future. So, yeah, there you go. Got the list.
All right, so I was Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Representative Stark, Vice Chair Representative Sanchez. So as mentioned, we all got together at a policy conference to come up with the ideas that we wanted. We had come up with 7 policy recommendations. The first one was long-term connections. Which I'm going to scare you all. I'm going to talk about permanency. Foster youth are being put in unwanted permanent situations, permanency plans. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we don't want permanency in our life. It's just that for me, when I entered, I was 15 years old, and I already knew who my mother and father were, and the idea of guardianship frightened me, terrified me. And I was placed in kinship care. Granted, they were relatives that I wasn't close with, but the idea of not having the support and the safety net of the foster care system behind me in DHS was terrifying. What if something went wrong? What if it didn't work out? So having the safety net of DHS was huge. I had a lawyer, I had a judge, I had a caseworker, the foster care ombudsman. So to have those resources, it makes you feel more secure. It's not that we don't want a forever family or permanency. It's just that it's terrifying, especially at the rate that they're trying to place people into permanent situations. In my opinion, you do not know who your forever family is in 6 months, which... How can you? How can you truly know someone in 6 months or 3 months or even a year? So it's just, we didn't like that. We wanted to have more say in it. As one of the policy recommendations was the Sibling Bill of Rights that we took to legislation. We also have quality of foster homes. So one of them was youth were experiencing mistreatment simply because the foster parent or caseworker did not understand how to properly handle conflict, which resulted in mentally and emotionally unstable home for the youth. So our recommendation was mandatory DHS training and collaborative problem solving should be added to foster parents and caseworkers. Another one was youth in care often feel left out because they're unsure of where they stand in the house, such as could be, well, your bedtime is this time, or curfew is this, open fridge. It wasn't a clear set of the expectations of the house or the case plan, things such as that. So our policy recommendation was to improve first contact communication process. DHS should make it mandatory to meet with everyone involved in the case, such as the attorney, the caseworker, foster parent, the youth, within the first 5 days to go over home expectations. Youth expectations tend to get to know each other in the new home. Another one we have is a lack of thoroughness in the background check, screening process, and home visits. Was negatively impacted to the quality of the foster homes. So we recommended that DHS implement the SAFE model for background checks and the screening process, as well as mandating monthly home visits using a physical checklist instead of just saying, okay, well, I checked, to have them check it off as they actually had to go through the effort. Another one was supporting youth who are in care between the ages of 18 and 21. So there aren't enough DHS caseworkers and care providers who support and acknowledge towards the LGBTQ plus community within state care. So our policy recommendation is that DHS support LGBTQ youth to feel safe and able to open up to their care providers without religion and judgment being obstacles. LGBTQ youth should have access to resources and be supported in seeking out those resources. And lastly, our seventh policy recommendation is a lack of transition-oriented discussion of activities during the 30-day visitations. Our policy recommendation would be DHS create specialized training in caseworkers geared towards youth 18 to 21. DHS offer those specialized workers to help youth ages 18 to 21 transfer to adulthood.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I want to say something, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. So again, similar to Representative Gorsuch, more of a comment than a question. I very much appreciate the work you guys have done on this, and I appreciate how responsive you've been to, you know, just small detail changes, and we've talked about a number of things. And one of them that you've already mentioned, the mandated ongoing involvement after post-adoption, mm-hmm. as important as that contact is, there's a handful of really messy situations that make that really difficult. So I appreciate the change of wording that you guys have done that to really help facilitate that, but also make sure that put forward an understanding that it doesn't always work because it's a broken world and things are messy. So appreciate your guys' work. I'm curious who else is testifying on this, because I do have a question about one of the logistics on it, and I don't know that you guys would know the details of how the department will implement it.
DHS.
So I'll save that question.
We'll save it, but DHS is here in order to answer any technical questions. I just wanted to say a couple of things and give the opportunity for the co-chief sponsor to close. I think your example of permanency, and I've been to the last three of your biennial conferences, have been very powerful. But the example of the permanency, how we as adults think it's really important, and we judge how quickly we can get you into permanency, and we've been doing actually a very bad job on that with foster youth not finding a permanent home within 3 years. I think we have one of the relatively higher rates of that, and we've been thinking that is so important. And to hear your perspective on how hard it is to be, and I remember that one of the main speakers at your conference talking about how he was asked to by his foster family to would he like to be adopted, and he was so terrified of hurting the feelings of his biological dad, who was trying so hard and he kept bouncing in and out of that family, but he didn't want to reject his biological dad, but he wanted to remain with his foster family, and because he turned down the adoption, he ended up having to leave that family, and how devastating that was. So understanding the nuances of that and your perspective is so important. So one of the things I would like to ask you to do is to make sure that you submit those 7, I think it was, recommendations to OLIS, so we have that on the record, and continue to talk with us in this, some of the things that you talked about in terms of collaborative problem solving perhaps could be worked into some of the other bills, in fact, that we're hearing today in terms of training. So there are other ways, even if it's not a whole new bill, that we might be able to incorporate some of those concepts. I just want to also say that you have a batting average of, well, however you describe that, I don't know, it's 1,000, 100%. Okay, I'm not good on the sports analogy, but every single bill that you have brought that has arisen and come to the top as the top priorities that you focus. You have a lot of things you want to do. You've put your energy in one or two places every single session, every single time it's passed. From my recollection, four sessions ago, it was college free tuition. The one 2 years later was the Foster Youth Bill of Rights, which this is building on, and that ensured that there were certain things, like if you wanted to get a driver's license or other things, and that was posted, and it was clear that everyone needed to see that. Last year we had two bills. One was, again, building on that, the right to do an activity, and then the second one was the right to have a savings account, and now you're bringing this forward. So I just want to just say, you know, huge kudos to your, and also huge kudos to Children First, who houses and supports the Oregon Youth Foster Connect program. It's really just been phenomenal. You've had profound impact on the hundreds of foster kids in the system that get to benefit from your work. So thank you.
Madam Chair, that's called a home run.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to say thank you all for being here. And when I get to meet with you and walk with you and talk with you and laugh with you, it is comforting me to know that my replacement is in place, that you all are taking our jobs in the near future, and we will be much better off for it. So thank you for that. I'm looking forward to you taking on the good fight, as you all have done with every what you just rattled off. Those great, but you did it for yourself. You know, we try to be here to help and to support, but it's your task, and you are up for the task, all of you, and it is amazing and it is inspirational. Again, I look forward to you replacing us. I look forward, you are our legacy, but more important, you're your own legacy, and you are building a great, great, strong one. So I am proud and honored to be associated with you. You know you are welcome, I'm sure, in any of our offices, in any of our homes, at any time. But I look forward to this continued good work and to be a part of it. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
That's great. Okay, thank you so much. And now we'll call up DHS. Answer any technical questions. Oh, and also there's Mary Sell. Would you like to come up as well?
Sure. Yes,
thank you. Yes, come on up. You could come together.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Mary, I don't know if yours will be any technical.
It's not going to be technical,
okay,
but just a voice and support.
Okay. Why don't you go first, then, and we'll let the technical questions be at the end.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am a defense attorney, and I'm also here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. You've already heard from the most important people in this room, and I just want to commend all of the young people who came here today to support their legislation. OCDLA is here at the table simply as a voice in support of 2216. When we saw this and heard about this, we definitely wanted to make sure that we were here telling you that a huge portion of the membership of OCDLA represent children and parents in dependency cases. I myself have been a juvenile practitioner. I practiced in Douglas County and also in Washington County for close to 4 years before going over to the Public Defender's Office, and then I'm now here in front of you. I represented many children, and I know many of our membership represent juveniles in dependency court. And what we want to be able to do and what's so important to us is to be able to walk into court and have something to point to and say, these children have rights to each other. And it is so important, and I know that that's not lost on the members of this committee. Many stories come to mind, but one in particular where I represented a sibling set essentially abandoned by their mother, thrust into the foster system due to the death of their father. The only other person that they had was each other. The only relationship that they had, truly, because there was no family for them to go to, they were ultimately taken in by this amazing, amazing community family. There was a moment in time where one of the children was able to be adopted, or adoption was an option for him, but it wasn't an option for the sister. And they didn't want to leave each other. And we were lucky in that the agency was listening and that the state was listening. But being able to walk into court and point to something such as this Bill of Rights is amazing. And so, really, all I wanted to do is come here today and say thank you to the sponsors, thank you to this committee for considering this, and OCDLA is in support, and we are asking for your yes votes. So thank you so much today.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, you have a technical
question? Yes. So thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. Can you share with me what is... One of the lines in here is to be provided with transportation and to maintain contact and have visits with sibling. Will you share with me what the current DHS policies are as far as providing transportation for sibling contact? And do you foresee, especially if there's out-of-state cases, an increase in need for funding specifically around this due to transportation out-of-state if it's different than what you currently do?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee, thank you for your question. Currently, we go about transportation in a lot of different ways. We don't have a big bucket of money that we draw
from. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you state your name for
the
record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, yes. Stark, members of the committee. My name is Lori Price. I'm Deputy Director for Child Welfare Program here in Oregon. Thank you for your question. Transportation happens in a lot of different ways. We work very closely with our foster families to keep that connection. We're very fortunate with the foster families that we have, that many of them continue to support those relationships when siblings must be separated. Currently, Oregon is has the highest percentage of sibling placements in the nation. We're at about 82-83%. That still leaves a good 17-18% of sibling groups that are not together. So when it's not possible to keep sibling groups together, we work with our foster families to arrange for transportation. We work with our caseworkers to arrange for transportation. We work with our SSAs, our social service assistants, to arrange for transportation. It's part of what we do. You threw a little lump in there with the out-of-state. Certainly, if there's an out-of-state sibling group and we're arranging for transportation, there's a cost associated with that, but I would not imagine that would be a fiscal, given the large amount of groups that we already have together and the amazing people that we work with that are willing to help transport and maintain those connections for our youth. So whether it's I'll pick this one up after practice, I'll pick this one up after school, we'll have dinner together on Sunday, we really work with our foster families to help us maintain that sibling connection, and we'll continue to do that in a much stronger way.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. I'm going to
actually.
I'm sorry.
A question. Is there? Thank you. I'm just curious, just because of communication is so darn easy. I can talk to my husband right now, and nobody even knows it, right?
How's he doing?
I'm, maybe that guy over there with the camera. But communication is so much easier nowadays, and I'm just curious as to why that's such a struggle with foster kiddos, not seeming to be some kind of block that they can't communicate as well, even via technology in some way. I'm unclear as to why that's I mean, I know that it can happen, but I feel like from the stories that I've heard from kiddos that it's sometimes a huge, huge struggle, and I'm wondering what that's about and why we're not implementing some kind of way to make that easier for kids or communicating with foster parents that should be easier for kiddos.
Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, thank you for your question. I agree with you. Technology makes communication very easy. Oftentimes, when siblings are separated, there's a reason. But I would say that there are other reasons that play a part in that. If we have an extraordinarily large sibling group, we have a foster care shortage, a shortage of foster parents statewide. So if we have a foster family that can take two children or three children and there's a five children sibling group, that remains a challenge for us, and we're actively trying to address that each and every day. As far as the communication pieces, I would really have to defer to our young people here about some of the barriers around technology, whether it's a restriction of technology in our homes for various reasons. I had the pleasure of spending time with them over the weekend at Willamette University and helping them arrive at these issues. And that's why I think this one is so important, if we can get this on the record. And I think that there are things that we can do. I'm proud of the number of sibling groups that we have together, but I always think we can do better. And as I mentioned, if that leaves 17 or 18% of our sibling groups separated, we need to do a better job of that, of providing for the safety and support of our sibling groups so that they can remain together whenever possible, and providing enough resources statewide that we can accommodate larger groups of siblings. That's certainly one of our biggest challenges right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may add a little bit more before I leave, I do want to mention that we've been working very closely with this young group of folks and an expanded young group of folks in a foster youth advisory committee that we meet with them monthly. We are going through their list of recommendations that came out of their work product after their summit at Willamette University, and we're trying to work through with them on whether there are issues that need additional legislative changes, or whether there are things that DHS can just do, mm-hmm. or whether there are things that we currently do that we could do better or enhance. So just wanted to get that on the record, that they're a great partner with
us. When did that advisory group start?
The advisory group started after the summit this time, right after the leadership change in DHS.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2216 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2221. And Cassie, could you please read us a summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2221 directs Oregon Health Authority and Department of Consumer and Business Services to report to the Legislative Assembly each calendar year on implementation of child abuse medical assessments, including reimbursements, number of grievances, and consumer complaints 30 days after the effective date. The bill also requires OHA to pay 9% interest rate on late child abuse medical assessment reimbursements to community assessment centers. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, first up we have Allison Kelly, Patty Terziar, and Shelley Smith.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Allison Kelly, and I serve as the CEO of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center that serves Marion and Polk counties. And I also am serving this year as the chair of the board of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse and Intervention Centers. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I have just a few short points. I did submit a letter that has more detailed testimony that hopefully you have in front of you and you have on the system. I would like to suggest that this is the issue that sets up the need for foster care, child abuse, neglect, physical, all of the conditions that I described in my letter. And I also want to echo what was said before. I think those voices that you heard from our young people, that's the most important testimony you'll hear today, if not in your entire career. They were fabulous. Couple of quick points, and then I'll defer to the rest of our guests. Child abuse is the most critical and deadly public health emergency facing the state of Oregon. All the things that I described in my letter that happened to children happen in our state to children every hour of every day of the year. It is a crisis. With that, the intervention that is made possible by the intervention centers is critical. That's what helps stop the abuse. It's what helps get children on the path to healing from the abuse, and it's what helps prevent the further abuse. It's a force multiplier. So the funding, the issue, is that the model will never be able to be completely reimbursed with a traditional medical model, and that was why it was House Bill 2234 2 years ago. What this bill ultimately we're hoping to get is just reimburse the costs. We're not sure the letter quite, or the language quite gets there, but that's what the hope is. Couple of quick facts, just for the record, the effects of child abuse and neglect. The researchers tell us we'll have an aggregated average lifetime cost of between $210,000 and $250,000 per person. That's the DHS, the law enforcement, the medical, the rehab, drug treatment, all of it. If you multiply that by the 11,000 confirmed cases roughly in the state of Oregon every year, it gets to be a pretty big number. So this is an investment, and there's a return on that investment. The last thing that I will say, as far as the scale at our center, we are being inundated with calls. We're getting between 5 and 10 calls on for consultation or to see kids pursuant to Carly's Law every single day. We can't keep up due to lack of funding. And the issue that has become crystal clear to me in my time at Liberty House is that the reason Carly's Law is so important is that you really do need medical providers and forensic interviewers with that specialized training, because it's never only about the injury. It's never only about the injury. Child abuse assessment is the only medical discipline I can think of where causation is always a part of the diagnosis. And unless you have direct testimony, direct evidence, you're always going to be in the realm of probability or likelihood. So you can have a little tiny bruise, but if you have a whole host of red flags going on, a whole host of risks, then you have a better picture of what could be happening. And that is the road to preventing the deaths. That's the road to preventing the fatalities. So that's why fully funding these assessment centers is just so important. And well, we think this bill helps.
I know Senator Gelser was a big champion and brought us Carly's Law. Could you just explain for the committee what that is?
I can. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. Thank you for the question. Carly's Law is in statute at Oregon Revised Statute 419B-022 through 024, and it provides that it's written with an audience of DHS CPS workers and law enforcement investigators, so that when they're in the middle of an investigation and they see a child with suspicious physical injuries, the law has certain provisions. It's not only that they're in investigation, there's suspicious physical injuries, and there's a list in the statute, it's including but not limited to, but also that there's reasonable suspicion that those injuries could have been caused by abuse. So that's really where the analysis comes in, that reasonable suspicion. Who's in the life of that child? What kind of access do they have? Do they have a long line of felony convictions in their past? What's the environment like? And so if those three things are present, the investigation, the injury, and that reasonable suspicion, then some requirements of the law kick in, that that child needs to be seen by that designated medical provider within 48 hours. And the law requires every county in the state to designate a medical provider, and most of our child abuse centers serve in that role. And pictures have to be taken immediately, because those injuries heal quite rapidly sometimes. What we find, as many times as I've tried to, let me finish that discussion, the law does have a safety valve that if you can't get, that it provides that reasonable efforts must be made to be seen by the DMP. If you can't get in to see the DMP, you can be seen by another medical provider, and that provider then has the duty to provide the records and imaging or whatever studies to the DMP for review. So we train very carefully in our two counties. Don't close that case before we've had a chance to do that review, because one of a couple of different scenarios might occur. We might agree. We might disagree. When it's seen by a non-specially trained provider, you have a risk of either being over-diagnosing, where abuse, you diagnose abuse and it actually isn't going on. You have a risk of missing a diagnosis if there is abuse, so that's why. And it's a safety valve. It's intended to try to catch things that are really going on in the lives of children. So when we get these 5 to 10 calls, 50 to 60 calls a week, in addition to the other 600 kiddos that we're seeing for traditional lengthy assessments, as my medical director tells me, Allison, I'm fishing for that one that I really need to make sure we pay attention to, because that's the child that could die over the weekend. Mm. That's the critical life and death. And one last point, the reason for this bill is that most all of our centers are nonprofits. We can't cover our costs. Billing doesn't cover it. The CAMI grant doesn't cover it. So we have to do fundraisers. I mean, and as my medical director also asks me on a weekly basis, I don't know of any other doctor that has to have bake sales and auctions and fund runs to pay their fee, and doctors don't come cheap. So it's an issue. So I apologize for the long-windedness. I always promise people I'm not going to talk too long, and then I end up talking too long.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. Chair Kenny Geyer, vice chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patty Terzian. I am the executive director of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. I work with Oregon's 21 different child abuse intervention centers to help ensure a coordinated and effective response to child abuse throughout the state. Our centers serve over 6,600 kids every year. We know that that's not all of the kids that need our care, but those are the ones that we're able to help see. When House Bill 2234 passed in 2015, it was to ensure that centers could bill insurance for portions of the child abuse assessment that weren't previously billable, and also to make sure that those reimbursements were reasonable given the scope and intensity of the services provided. These are really unique services that are being provided. It's not your typical, you know, pop in the doctor for 15-minute appointments. Historically, some of our centers were billing for the portions of the assessment that were already billable, but of the 75% of kids seen by our centers that are covered by Medicaid, we were only receiving about 24% back on what was billed. So just a huge, gap there that we're trying to fill. The purpose of the law was to really provide consistent support across the state so we can ensure that these services are available everywhere that kids need them across the state, regardless of where they reside. As a result of House Bill 2234, we have seen some successes. We've had some CCOs who really understand the intent of the law, who value the early intervention that our centers can provide. And we really applaud those CCOs who have taken a step and provided some leadership to set a good example and to provide our centers with reasonable reimbursement rates. There are still problems, however, as you will hear from some of our center directors that are speaking today. And particularly, the biggest problem seems to be a lack of clarity around the expectation of House Bill 2234. So we feel like House Bill 2221 is really an opportunity to clarify the law, to define the expectation for reimbursements, and to ensure that there's some accountability. I would encourage this committee to consider reimbursement that fully takes into the account the scope and intensity of the services provided, which is how the language in the bill is. What we mean by that is 100%. Our centers are billing the true cost of providing these services. We're not pulling numbers from anywhere. We're really billing what it costs to provide these services. These are critical services to help us stop abuse when it's occurring, help kids heal so they can be healthy adults. And we believe that defining the expectation will help provide some more consistent coverage while also giving OHA and the CCOs some guidance on what's expected. We really need OHA's help and leadership to ensure that the law is having the intended impact, and we believe that House Bill 2221 will do that. Thank you for the opportunity, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. We'll save questions to the end of the panel.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geiger and Vice Chair Sanchez and Stark and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is Shelley Smith, and I'm the Executive Director of Kids Center in Bend. We serve the Central Oregon area and have been since 1994. I've been with Kids Center for 8 years, and my background is in nonprofit management, and my actual degree is in marriage and family therapy. I never intended to get into the insurance reimbursement arena, and one of the things that I can take now is that I have a better understanding of this area and some of the challenges that we all face. So prior to House Bill 2234, when we would sit down with our insurance companies to negotiate the rates, we had little power or understanding of what we were actually doing. So we at Kids Center in Bend are a medical model, meaning that we conduct a medical exam with every child abuse assessment. Again, that's not an inexpensive challenge. It's a luxury to have doctors, nurse practitioners that have spent years honing their expertise in being able to define and diagnose child abuse. One of the challenges of sitting down with them is that we never had any type of teeth or background or any type of foundation to say that these rates didn't meet the needs of our organization. So the CCO structure is a great structure, and it helps us to better understand the needs of our community and be able to serve our community. But the unfortunate part is that when we sit down to have these negotiations, oftentimes we aren't able to express with passion and with power in the situation to negotiate those higher rates. So House Bill 2234 really tried to give us something to bring to the table to sit with our CCOs. In Central Oregon, Pacific Source is our CCO. And before I talk about our experience, I'd like to highlight MODA. MODA stepped up to the table after the passage of this bill and said, we will reimburse you at cost for your commercial contracts 100%. We will give you 50% of your cost for your Medicaid clients. Now, MODA only serves Harney County, which is a small county that we serve with a direct contract. So that's really not going to impact our bottom line. But what will impact our bottom line is Pacific Source stepping up to the table to say, we hear what this bill was intended to do, and we're going to support it. And it's taken us 9 months and hiring a healthcare consultant that not only has a PhD, but actually created some of the first Medicaid contracts in the state of Oregon and has worked relentlessly to ensure that Medicaid is carried out appropriately. She's retired from that field, but we hired her to help us have this conversation. As I said, 9 to 10 months later, we still have not signed a contract with our CCO to provide this very vital service, to provide more than 20% of the cost of each child abuse assessment. In Bend, we see over 420 kids a year for a full medical assessment. Our budget is $2.5 million. And I can tell you right now that we have to raise money. Over 50% of our budget comes from our community and the generosity of donors, corporations, foundations. It's not coming from the reimbursement of this insurance billing. So what I would ask you to do is to please consider the letter that I've submitted and some of the work that we've been doing, and hope that Pacific Source and Kids Center will soon be able to sign a contract that better supports the work that we do on behalf of children's most vulnerable members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very detailed descriptions of what the problems are. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Corzine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question, and this is probably something that some of the other folks that have been here longer know, but how do kids get referred into this? What is the source of the children that are coming to these assessment centers?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, thank you for the question. Representative Gorsuch, children typically get referred to these assessment centers in one of three ways.
Okay.
If they're DHS caseworker through that multidisciplinary team process, after doing that initial field interview and investigation, feels that they need a deeper assessment, they can make a referral. A law enforcement officer or detective typically can make a referral. Parents or children or parents can self-refer if they have questions. Our staff at Liberty House spends a lot of time every year just answering calls from people, you know, saying my child just came home from some experience, you know, either overnight at somewhere or whatever, and I just don't really understand what they're saying, and frankly, I'm kind of scared. Could you help me understand what this means? And then our family support specialists will be able to have that dialogue and get a sense of whether they need to make a mandatory report and get that child in. I would mention responding to child abuse allegations is very complicated, and I think Oregon has exceptional public policy, and you really find it in ORS 418-747, and that's the statute that says in every county, the district attorney will convene a multidisciplinary team for responding. Basically, Oregon says, this is hard, work together. And so we staff. At Liberty House, we're right on the verge of co-locating DHS and law enforcement. We're trying to put together a pilot project so that we can streamline and just get more services to more kiddos.
Follow up?
Yep.
So what we have is a public system that's feeding into nonprofits. And then the problem is that the nonprofits aren't being properly compensated.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, the funding, there is also in the statute the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account. That's CAMI. It's administered through DOJ. And it funds the centers get a grant. The grant doesn't pay for, in our case, it pays for about 30% of what it costs. We are able to, through the billable reimbursements, have another 33% come in, and the other 33% come from the auctions, luncheons, fundraisers, dragon boat race. So it's very nerve-wracking to try to meet payroll on that basis.
Representative Nearman?
Good, thanks, Chair.
Thank you.
So I'm kind of new to human services, so you'll have to cut me some slack a little bit. And this question's for any one of you. First of all, thanks for your presentation, and thanks for the work that you do. I appreciate that. These assessments are, I take it that they're partly medical and that they're partly forensic then, right? So who does the medical part? Is it always a doctor? Or I think I heard nurse practitioner mentioned. And then who does the forensic part? Is that still the medical professional? Or do you have other people that do that?
Sure. Chair Kenny-Geiger, mm-hmm. Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, Representative mm-hmm. Nearman. Typically, child abuse assessment centers have a couple things in common across the state. So there's 21 centers. So just to kind of give you a landscape, of those 21 centers, we offer different layers of services. So I would say that every center will offer a forensic interview and advocacy for the family. And then other centers will offer, on top of that, the medical exam on-site or have a linkage agreement to have that medical exam conducted at a hospital by a professional that's been trained. And then other centers will have therapy on-site or linkage agreements or prevention services on-site or with other community partners. Your question is the type of background. So a forensic interview is typically conducted by someone who has had extensive training, whether it's a graduate level. In addition, they would have the child forensic interview training that's a national accredited or nationally approved training. And then many hours and months of training and support before they start to do those forensic interviews. They're very different from anything that I had ever experienced. They're open-ended questions. They're really trying to draw out any experience that child has had. It's recorded. It's the one piece that we record that goes in and actually speaks for the child in the criminal or dependency process. Our medical examiners range from nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to physicians, DOs, MDs. And it really depends on the system, the center, and the needs of the community about who would be conducting those exams. But those are the minimal qualifications of those two positions.
May I also respond?
Yeah. And we'll probably have to start moving on.
Okay.
Yeah. We've got other people to testify. So.
one point I'd add, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, and Representative Nierman. There are a lot of reasons why kids are not going to want to say anything. If there's DV going on in the house, they're going to be afraid of retribution.
It's domestic violence.
If they're themselves are being subject to rape night after night after night, it's so embarrassing. It's so personal. They feel feelings of guilt and shame, and it's all my fault. And why? And typically, the researchers say it takes a child 7 times of telling an adult before an adult listens and actually takes action. So they've already said it 7 times, and then so the repeated trauma of having to keep saying it over and over again. This whole model is designed to lessen that trauma by bringing the professionals to the child. As Shelley was saying, the appointments go very slowly. Children have experienced a lot of trauma. That's why the need you hear for trauma-informed care. Mm-hmm. Their amygdalas, their brains, they are on fire, red alert 24/7. And so the pace at a child abuse assessment center is very slow. The color palette is pretty mild. We give the child a little power back. They get to decide, you know, will we do this or that? And sometimes they'll come in for that medical. Our center does do medical assessments, and they'll get through height and weight and maybe eyes and blood pressure. We do a complete checkup in addition to the injury, and then they're done. They can't take any more. And so our medical providers have all that training in trauma where they can say, okay, but we're here if you change your mind. So it's an art. Those appointments can last 4 hours.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question, Representative Nierman. And some of the other bills that we'll be hearing have to do with trauma-informed care and training. So this is all a good segue to later bills. Thank you so much for your testimony. We've got Russell Mark and anyone else to testify?
Madam Chair, esteemed members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us this opportunity to talk about this legislation. My name is Russell Mark. I'm the president and CEO of Juliet's House, a child abuse intervention center headquartered in McMinnville, serving Yamhill, Tillamook, Polk counties, and including Grand Ronde. We are this year celebrating our 20th anniversary providing medical and forensic child abuse assessments, family support services, and a pretty robust child abuse prevention education program to children and adults, especially those that work with children. Our intent is to not only deal with kids who have been abused, but to do everything in our power to make our communities as safe as possible and to prevent before abuse occurs. As my colleagues have said, child abuse is truly a public health emergency, not just in Oregon, but of course across the country. It's estimated by the Centers of Disease Control that 1 in 4 children before the age of 18 will be significantly abused. It's hard to imagine the child sitting next to you at church, the child you see playing in the park, your child, your neighbor's child is a potential target for abuse. And yet, that is the reality that we live with. And we hope and pray that that never happens to us or anyone we know, but it is the reality for so many of the families that we each serve in our own communities. Standing in that breach, along with DHS, law enforcement, the DA's office, crime victims assistance, and other community agencies that Allison spoke to about being members of our community MDTs, CAICs, child abuse intervention centers like Juliet's House and those you've heard from, provide services to all of the children, over 10,000 children in the state of Oregon last year that were recognized as having been abused. The bill that is being discussed, 2221, will help us move forward and to stabilize and help with funding. It's that simple. The work that we do, as my colleagues have talked about, is potentially life-saving. 3 days ago, I had a father in Juliet's House who was having an emotional breakdown because his 12-year-old daughter had just disclosed that she'd been raped by a neighbor somebody he knew, somebody he had been fishing with. I walked for an hour with him in our parking lot trying to help him realize his daughter's life is not over. She will be a survivor, but he's a critical component to making her a survivor and to feel like a survivor. That's part of the healing process that we do. It's not that they walk through our doors and in one day, in a few hours, we do an assessment, we do a forensic interview, we write a bunch of notes and make referrals, and then they're gone. We work with these families for up to a year. 2 weeks ago, we got a call from an aunt whose nephew had been to Juliet's house 5 years ago. He was just now, at the age of 16, emotionally dealing with the fact that the father had beaten him and sexually abused him. He was acting out. He was using drugs. He was starting to cut himself. The family didn't know what to do, and the aunt said in desperation, "I'm calling Juliet's house." We were able, through our Family Support Services program, to get that young man into counseling. And in just a short while, we're told, as of yesterday, he's no longer cutting himself. He's getting alcohol treatment. His anger management is much better than it was when he started. 5 years later, we're still making an impact in that child's life and in that family's life. It's sometimes hard to remember that child abuse doesn't affect just a single victim, but also everybody in that family, everybody in that neighborhood, everybody in that community. A study came out last year from the San Francisco Center for Child Abuse Prevention and the Haas Business School at UC Berkeley. They estimate in the city of San Francisco alone, untreated child abuse costs at least $400,000 per child per year. And because it is so vastly underreported, the estimation could be as high as $5.6 billion that the city of San Francisco is spending in unemployment and dropouts and all of the related substance abuse care, all of the related issues that come with a child who has not been intervened early in their life because of child abuse. Now, McMinnville is certainly not San Francisco. Neither is Salem.
We have to wrap up soon.
Okay.
Because we've got other bills to
wrap it up real quick. We can make a huge difference by helping through this bill to stabilize and improve the funding for CAICs. It provides greater accountability and moving the intent of 2234 further along. We work close with our CCOs. We work closely with OHA. If we can improve communication and clarity on what your intent is and what our need is, we think we can make a much bigger difference in our communities. Thank you so much, and I appreciate the good work that you all do.
Okay, thank you so much. Anyone else to testify in this bill? Is there anyone in opposition of the bill? There are no amendments that are being suggested at this point. And so my intention would be to move the bill pretty quickly. And I'd like to give the last word to Vice Chair Stark, who's co-chief sponsor.
Just wanted to take a moment and thank you guys for the work that you do. I wish there wasn't a need for these assessment centers, but there is. And, you know, I've had to use them. Okay, so I've been there. I'm familiar with the work you guys do. And it's really easy when you deal with child abuse to get overwhelmed by the darkness and the trauma and the tragedy of it all. And I'm so proud of you guys, because in a child, what we hope is their darkest hour that they ever live. In their darkest hour, you guys are like shining angels. And you somehow manage to balance the medical and forensic professionalism with the heart of Mother Teresa. And you really do give them hope. And so we thought that we already took care of this 2 years ago. We need to take care of it now. I hope all of you guys will get online and hit the little button to sign on to this, because we need to make sure that this, out of all the things we cover, we need to deal with this. We need to make sure it's covered. So I encourage you to jump on. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stark. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2221 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2344. Cassie, please read us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the
Committee, House Bill 2344 revises qualifications for minors to participate in independent living programs. The bill modifies activity requirements of residents in independent living programs to include volunteer activities and allowing exceptions to the requirements.
Thank you. So we've got Lori Price, Rosemary, and Alexis Baska. Why don't you come on up? We're going to try to fly through these a little more quickly. This appears to be some more technical changes and maybe some substantive changes, but describe to us why this is needed and what you plan on doing.
Hi, Chair Ken Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Stark, and members of the committee. My name is Rosemary Ivandetti. I am the Independent Living Program Coordinator for Department of Human Services Child Welfare, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2344. The Independent Living Housing Subsidy Program, also referred to as the Subsidy Program for short, provides financial support to foster youth who are ready to experience living independently. So they're not being returned home, they're not going into guardianships or adoptions, and they're ready to have that experience of that real life hands-on opportunity to practice their money management skills, time management. That is what the subsidy program provides, financial support to assist them with doing that. The current law requires youth to maintain full-time productive hours, which does not allow for any exceptions. So if we have a young person who is maybe employed full-time and that's their productive hours and they lose that job for whatever reason, it could be to no reason of their own, they're now out of compliance and can no longer participate on the program when they need the assistance the most. So that's the biggest issue that this House Bill 2344 is attempting to address. It does allow, also we're asking to allow the department to create individualized plans for our young people based on their skills and abilities. So it would allow us to potentially have less than full time if that is all that that young person can handle at that time. They may have post-traumatic stress disorder that keeps them from being able to engage for longer periods of time. And or we also want to allow them to, maybe they're in counseling sessions, as to include that as part of the allowable hours for productive activity. Again, currently it is very strict in that it's paid employment or education hours is what is to be calculated in that full-time employment. We also do have some technical changes to the bill that are coming that aren't quite ready yet, but those will be coming. Again, they're minor changes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alexis, how about you go next?
All right. Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez. For the record, my name is Alexis Baska. So this would have helped me in particularly. I was going to school down in Southern Oregon, and I am from Northern Oregon, about as north as it gets. So I was very far from home and my resources and my support system, which was difficult for me to handle and cope with. So I had decided to leave school and return home. Well, because I was leaving school, I was no longer at 40 hours, and I was only on 12 credits, so I was still only at 36 hours. I didn't know a whole lot about Southern Oregon. It was my first time ever being there, and I decided to go to school there, so I didn't know where I could find those extra 4 hours. It was difficult for me, but coming home was the most difficult part. So because I did not meet the 40 hours for the entire month, each week for the entire month, I did not receive subsidy. So I had, and on subsidy, there isn't a plan so you can build up savings necessarily. So I had no resources to try to get back home. Thankfully, I had a relative who assisted me with that. And even though I had a job lined up for when I returned home the next day, even because it wasn't full time, I could not access subsidy either. It was super difficult. The amount of stress that I underwent, I started having panic attacks, anxiety attacks. Because I'm just a 19-year-old kid trying to transition from
one end of the state to the other. And because I wasn't going into a foster care placement, they couldn't receive. I moved in with my grandmother, who later became my foster parent. But at that time, she was just a stable person in my life that was allowing me to stay there until I got back on my feet. However, she was on disability, so she's on a fixed income. So there wasn't a whole lot that she could do. And because I was getting a job, but I hadn't started yet, I didn't have an income coming in, so there was no way that I could help support myself. So just having an individual plan, I think, is a huge thing, especially for cases like that, where it's not that I wasn't trying to work or be successful, it was something that wasn't available due to the 40 hours a week.
So, Alexis, we're getting close to the end of the hearing and more bills to hear, but I take it that you're incredibly supportive of the bill to add flexibility so that if it's we increase the range of requirements in order to comply with the program to allow for individual kind of cases like yours. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have to move us along. And would you like to say anything else about the bill?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Stark, I just want to reiterate that having some flexibility in this will allow us to better serve youth and meet them where they're at, yes, while holding them accountable to the degree that they're able to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. And I thank you for your consideration.
Can you say your name again for the record, please?
Lori Price, Deputy Director, Child
You and I
programs.
Are both forgetting.
Okay. Terrible.
Great. Thank you so much.
You.
Any quick questions?
And yep. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, and you can get back to me on this if we need more detail. If I understand the provision that you've built into the bill as far as calculating if there's a loss of employment, having that exclusion or temporary exclusion. I would like to, at some point, dialogue more on why include volunteer activities if you already have education and employment in that calculation, and that's one of the things that are built into the bill. And I don't know.
It's employment or volunteer.
Right.
Just quickly, it's the current law states employment, paid employment, or education. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't allow the flexibility to say, well, we want them to volunteer somewhere to gain the skills so that they become more employable. So we're just looking at, and again, if the counseling session is what is going to help this young person be successful in their endeavor to transition to adulthood, then we want to value that as well and not have it be such a narrow type of productive hours that are allowed.
Thank you. We'll look forward to seeing your technical amendments soon, please. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2344 and open the hearing on House Bill 2401. Cassie, please read us the summary.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2401 requires Department of Human Services and Department of Justice to provide trauma-informed training and curriculum, including interview models, symptom recognition, assessment tools, data collection, and methods improving placement stability for case planners and other persons involved in child welfare.
Great. And we've got Janet Ahrens, Kamala Sugar, I hope I'm saying that right, and Stacey Cowan, please. Janet, would you like to start?
I would love to. Thank you very much. Janet Ahrens, Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. Thank you so much. Doug, can you grab the testimony out of my briefcase for the committee members? My apologies. I'm still in the old school, so I didn't get everything sent in. I'll send it right after that. The hearing, so we have an electronic version available. So the Alliance represents about 44 different member agencies and touches the lives of over 100,000 children every year. Almost all of these kids have either suffered trauma in their lives or are in harm's way. The programs that take care of these kids are everything from prevention to psychiatric residential and everything in between. So one of the things that is in your testimony is a copy of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that we did, and I think probably most of you are aware of the ACEs study and its measurement of childhood trauma.
and understanding the impact on the lives of those kids as they move forward. The short data point here is that out of 10 childhood experiences that are recognized as being pretty traumatic for kids who are under 18 years old, 4 is the point at which these impacts become very, very measurable in terms of their behavior and their brain functionality and what they're able to achieve and not achieve. The average for the kids who are in the Alliance programs is around 6.1, and most concerning is the kids who are in treatment foster care, and they average around an 8. So very, very difficult numbers. So the core value of the programs in and the Alliance, of course, are to make sure that kids don't have additional traumatic experiences while they're in substitute care, out-of-home care. So not only is there a lot of internal work done, most all of these programs have had trauma-informed trainings. The Alliance did a training. There's a flyer there for you last month, where we had Dr. Mandy Davis come from Portland State University and Trauma-Informed Oregon and did some fantastic work, and we also tied that up with positive youth development, all trying to mitigate the impacts of trauma and make sure that people have new, refreshed information all the time about what's happening. And that's one of the important points. This isn't a two-hour training that you do at somebody's employment orientation and they're done then for the rest of their career. So the, some of our members actually have taken on Sanctuary, which is a very, very significant cultural embedding in their organizations to assure psychological, physical, social, and moral safety. And so there's a lot of conversation about trauma-informed care and what our responsibility is as a provider to be able to have that embedded in the culture of the our organizations. So understanding why trauma is important, the long and the short of it is, when you have traumatic experiences, when you're a child, your brain freezes up, and you have a hard time understanding consequences, seeing into the future, having a vision, having hope. And so you're really reacting spontaneously to the circumstances that are immediately in front of you. This is how kids and adults get in trouble. They're reactive. They are not thinking things through. And so consequences aren't a part of their future either. So it also makes it very, very difficult for these kids to be able to get through school. The impact of trauma and those kinds of behaviors means that these kids have the potential to not finish school, start smoking, do drugs, have inappropriate relationships, get into all kinds of trouble. And these are the social ills, and those in turn become chronic physical health issues for mid-adulthood and early death. And on the back of that piece of paper with the charts, it talks about what the impacts are, so you can take a look at that. So the impact of traumatic stress on kids' ability to achieve, or our ability to help them achieve safety and permanency and well-being, is really a unique challenge for the child welfare professionals, whether you're in whatever sector that you're in, including the other ladies here with me, and the work that we do in the provider, the private and community provider sector. So, so it includes a wide range of folks. The bill talks about case managers. We want to make sure that we're talking about investigators. There's foster parents. There's other workers. So in 1997, the Adoption Safe Families Act identifies some specific goals that we need as a state to be able to achieve, and permanency, safety, and well-being, very difficult to get to for kids who've been significantly traumatized. Very, even more difficult if the people who are caring for them don't have the ability to recognize the trauma, recognize the behaviors, and be able to mitigate those. So you'll see on page 2, there are 5 bullets underneath safety that talk about the inability to regulate moods or behavior, impairing the child's ability to describe a traumatic event, their lack of trust, the dulling of their emotions, so you're not always sure about what the impact is, and then a child's own altered world view leading to inappropriate behaviors that can be damaging to themselves and others. So the roles and responsibilities of regulators come into play as well. And one of the early concerns we have, you see this as pre-session filed, was when everybody was working really, really hard to try and make sure that we weren't letting kids slip through the cracks potential abuse or neglect, and making sure everybody's getting on board with the same level of concern and focus on child safety. And one of the things that we realized in that rush and the need of the department to try and find investigators to come and support this work was that people had no idea what had happened to these kids or who they were or how they were supposed to be conducting an investigation. And so it occurred to us that maybe we needed to step back a minute and take a look at how to get the training, appropriate training, to those folks who are going to have contacts with these kids, and in a broad area of ways.
Well, just because we're going to finish soon. So my understanding is that you would like to bring an amendment forward that would include some of those regulators.
Yes.
OWAPI licensing.
Well,
division,
yes. And we also would like to let the Department of Justice off the hook for having to provide the training and allow the department to decide for themselves who and where the best experts and best trainers will be for their personnel.
Okay, great. So strong support for the bill with those two caveats.
Yes, please.
Right. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for your help on that.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Sanchez and Vice Chair Stark. My name is Kamala Sugar, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice. We support the policy behind this bill and the idea of training investigators who have contact with traumatized children in these facilities. However, we are not convinced that the Department of Justice is the correct trainer of these investigators on trauma-informed care, and we would encourage an amendment that removes the Department of Justice as the identified trainer. However, and we believe that the Department of Human Services could contract with probably better qualified trainers in that area, which we would have to do, frankly, if we were the identified trainers. And I would just say, if after a period of time it appears as though that's not adequate, we'd be happy to have a conversation with anyone who wants to discuss it about whether we should be added back in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, Stacey Cowan. I'm with SEIU Local 503. SEIU represents thousands of workers, including those folks at DHS Child Welfare, and we just wanted an opportunity to add our voice in support of the legislation. When legislation like this comes up, we reach out to our members and get feedback and just try to really get a sense for what's really happening out in the field. And I heard some things back that I wanted an opportunity to share just really quickly. So first and foremost, we hear back from folks that they frequently appreciate the idea of more training and support, and that's just, you know, across the board, folks are really supportive of that, of course. I actually had an opportunity to speak with a worker who received trauma-informed care training that was facilitated by PSU, and she had just glowing reviews for the training and really, really loved it. So, you know, as we talk about it, and I think you did mention the PSU training, so just something to note for the record. And then a couple of other things that they talked about when we're talking about training, folks definitely shared with me this idea of making sure that the training is always high quality. There's nothing worse than having a very large caseload, which I'll touch on in a moment, being pulled away from your work and sitting in a training that maybe you feel like is not necessarily up to par, that it doesn't feel like it's a good use of your time. So, of course, we want to just encourage that it's the highest quality training and that it really is the best use of workers' time. One other thing that they noted, too, is that there's, you know, variety of trainings that workers received, making sure that once you receive a training that there's some idea of how we're actually implementing it in their work. And they said many times workers receive very good training that's hard to then roll over into their work. And this is a broad comment. I think the trauma-informed care obviously is very specific to the work that folks are doing with children. But, you know, making sure that there's some type of follow-up in the workplace, making sure that it really is applicable to their daily work. And then, of course, finally, I'd just be remiss without mentioning that, you know, anytime that you're weighing
legislation that's really looking at mandating training and then providing additional requirements on workers, we have to talk about caseload. There's a lot of concern right now that caseload is just unsustainable. We have workers that are working mandated overtime. Many workers, folks couldn't be here today because they worked till 10 o'clock at night trying to meet their needs. So again, anytime we're talking about pulling folks away from their clients, it really can just add to a stressful situation. We're obviously going to be talking about caseload and about staffing and the Ways and Means Committee, but I just think that it's really important when we're weighing legislation like this, which is really important, that we're really thinking about it through the full context. So we, again, just wanted an opportunity to put that on the record, and we're happy to engage in the conversation.
I'm actually really pleased you put that on the record, because this no one from this policy group is on the subcommittee, and we are going to want to be making some statements from this committee about how we feel about the budget. And to me, that is one of the critical points, because we'll get into this at another point. I think we should have a public informational session if we don't have any bills relating to budget. But the fact that the budget has been very low for caseworkers means that there's been enormous turnover. I think it's something like 40% for DHS caseworkers. And so what's the point of giving this training when people leave in a year?
And I recognize we're short on time. If I could just make one more comment, too. One of the things that's interesting is, as you know, we go out to workers and we talk about the caseload model and the funding, and, you know, the conversation is it enough? And, of course, you know, we knew anecdotally that caseloads were high, but really trying to get down to the crux of what the issue was. And as I was speaking with folks, you know, asking them, hey, should we be advocating for a higher caseload model, the concern actually came back was this idea that they're actually having trouble meeting, recruiting and retaining folks, and the vacancy rates. It is anecdotal based on the offices that I visited, and so we are trying to really track down that data, but this idea that they're not even at the approved caseload model, they're having trouble filling these positions. Mm-hmm. And then there is tremendous turnover, and, you know, there's a lot of conversation about what that does to a team that really relies on each other for support, for expertise, and for, you know, really to be an effective team. So, again, we're happy to engage in the conversation further and really, you know, talk about what we can do to make sure that we have good, high-quality workers providing this really valuable resource.
Great. Thank you. Any quick questions?
Quick comment. I'm familiar with trauma-informed sexual assault investigations, so if this is similar and provides the same benefits, I think this is a positive thing. One of the things we did find, though, is they're better and they're more efficient. So maybe find the same thing with caseloads, even though there is still a shortage and overworked.
Thank you, Representative Noble. Okay.
May I just thank the chair for her chief sponsorship position on this bill? I appreciate it very much. We'll
Forgot
be back
that.
With the rest of
you. Yay. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill. Let me see, which one are we on? 2401. Let me reopen that for 1 minute. I just want to point in the record that a youth who is at Warner Pacific College, who I've had the great pleasure of getting to know a little bit, and she shadowed me here in December, Emily, has a very, very powerful statement of the kinds of trauma that she went through, and now that she's volunteering with a nonprofit in a program through Metropolitan Family Services, they have been getting this kind of trauma-informed care, and she is saying how vitally important that is to have that holistic approach, you know, to have different people in the system either yell at you or whatever when you're already traumatized. So please read that letter. My intention on all these bills, I hope that people can bring the amendments to us even possibly by next week. I would love to work these bills while you're still kind of remembering it. Can everyone spend 3 more minutes? Because the last bill is actually very short. Can everyone stay for a little bit over time? I would love to hear this, because I want to move as many as we can, possibly as soon as next Thursday if we can get amendments. So I'm going to close that House Bill 2401, open a public hearing on 2500. Cassie, could you please read us the
Madam
summary?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2500 directs Department of Human Services to develop and implement caseworker training and continuing education, informing and instructing on juvenile dependency proceedings. The bill requires instruction and materials on engaging in legal practices and parameters from juvenile dependency judges and attorneys. The bill also requires continuing education for caseworkers every 2 years.
Okay. Are there anyone here to speak to this bill? I didn't think so. That's why we were trying to squeeze it in, because I knew there was no one here. This is brought to us by Representative David Brock Smith, who came and spoke to me about it, as well as... it's at the request of Representative Krieger, who is very passionate about these issues, a foster parent himself, and brought us a lot of good ideas, and am delighted to see that he's remaining engaged in this area, and also by Representative Arnie Roblin. And I think this very much goes in the vein of the previous bill of trying to do more continuing education and training in these areas. So I just wanted to make sure that it was highlighted so that people could see it. I don't think there's any controversy about it. I think it's a great idea. If anyone wants to consider any amendments or kind of dig in deeper to it, please do so, because my intention is to bring all of these back and work them at the same time if the amendments are ready, and hopefully send these on the way to the House floor. They're really important bills, and I'm really delighted that this is how we started our committee, with some bills that are, I think everyone can agree, is really, really important. And if we can take quick action on it, I think that's great.
And yes, comment, we may have a bill related to this as well that's going to be going through judiciary. That came out of a work group, so I'll see how the two compare and get back to you.
Perfect. That's great. Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the hearing for the Human Services and Housing Committee. Thank you all so much. The Human Services and Housing Committee, thank you all so much.